This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 4079 for Thursday, the 21st of March 2024. Today's show is entitled The Corresponding Source. It is hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 18 minutes long. It carries a clean flag. The summary is, free as in freedom is dead. Long live the corresponding source.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and you're listening to another episode of Hacker Public Radio. Previously we featured an episode of Free as in Freedom here in HPR from the good folks over at the Software Freedom Conservatory. They now have a new podcast called The Corresponding Source, which I found out about from our good friend, fellow podcaster and all-around nice guy, Dan Lynch. And I'm posting the first episode of The Corresponding Source, so you know that Free as in Freedom is no more and that you should switch your feeds over to this new podcast, The Corresponding Source. So with that, sit back, relax, and enjoy the first episode of The Corresponding Source.
This is episode 00 of The Corresponding Source.
I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is Corresponding Source.
This is a new show that we'll be doing for hopefully many episodes that's going to have lots of great information about open source, free software, software freedom, and software rights.
Yeah, I'd say probably also digital rights, electronic freedom, digital autonomy. I'm just being silly now, but you're not smiling. We are in the same room this time, which we often are. We weren't in our old show.
That's right. Many of our listeners who might be joining this show as we start will remember we previously had for many episodes a show called Free as in Freedom that ran for quite a long time. We had another podcast even before that, but we're trying to do something a little bit different with this particular podcast.
Here, we're going to kind of start from the beginning. We're going to talk about, well, first, in this episode, we're going to introduce you to who we are and why we care about these issues.
And then what we're hoping to do is have a series of episodes that are about the beginnings and inner workings and how free software and then open source became to be and what the things are that you need to know about issues related to policy, licensing, community, and just generally all the information you might need to know that's not in the software itself or the software's documentation to get involved and get excited about doing things in open source and free software.
And our goal is to provide all of that background and introductory information, but also to talk about some of the hot issues and more complicated subjects that come along that are connected to that background and history.
And what we're going to have, actually, is two different feeds that you can subscribe to. We know we have a lot of wonderful listeners that we like coming from our old show. I'm sure they're very thrilled that we're back, even under a new name. And they're probably going to be more interested in the more advanced topics and current issue shows we're going to do. And we're targeting, this might vary a little bit, but we're targeting to have every other show be one of the shows in the series of introductory information about open source and free software. And then every other show will be about more of a recent topic and so forth. We'll have a feed. The main feed will have both those types of shows in it. And for those who want one or the other, they can subscribe to a specific feed for one or the other type of episode.
That's cool. I didn't realize that's how we were going to do it.
That is how we're going to do it. I've had this plan in my head for so long, Karen. Finally, we're executing on the excellent plan that I have devised for the future of the Corresponding Source.
I'm here for it. My question is it Corresponding Source or The Corresponding Source? Let's explain what that means.
Shall we?
Yeah.
We picked this name from one of the most important and popular and famous free software licenses called the General Public License. And in fact, it's called in GPL version 2, the complete corresponding source. And in GPL version 3, it's a defined term. If you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. You'll learn in a future show, called corresponding source with CNS capitalized. And that's where we took it from, because getting the source code is one of the most important things. In fact, possibly the most important thing that you get with your rights, software rights with open source and free software.
And we're also corresponding, and I hope that we're a source for important information going forward. Did I ruin it by being too explicit about the little, the fun other meanings of the words?
Oh, I thought the pun was obvious, but maybe it wasn't.
I don't know, but I like it so much that, you know, I belabored it.
I came up with it. Karen liked it, but I came up with it.
Bradley totally came up with it. You get the credit.
That's great. Well, why don't we start by introducing ourselves? Karen, do you want to tell your story and, you know, your background and how you got involved in open source and free software and all? Just tell us your whole life story, Karen.
I was going to say, sure, I'd be happy to, but that would take a very long time. I'm probably not going to talk about all of the intricacies of my story during this one podcast, or this one episode, but we'll probably come back to some of the important pieces of the story over time. My story is sort of has like a lot of relevance to a lot of different issues about free and open source software. The basic story about who I am and why I care so much about these topics is that I have a heart condition that I was born with. It's called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It means I literally have a big heart.
So like what happened to the Grinch after he started caring about everyone? Three sizes too large or no?
It is three sizes too large.
Wow, exactly.
Yes.
And that's why you're such a wonderful person.
The whole thing is not three sizes too big, just pieces of it are.
I see.
Parts of it are. And really, it's not just that it's so big, it's that parts of the heart are thick, and so the heart muscle is kind of stiff, and it doesn't beat properly. And it's totally fine. I am generally asymptomatic, generally.
I'm glad to hear that.
But
I'm trying to react. See, I know this story, but I'm trying to react to Karen's story as if I'd never heard it before. I'm trying anyway.
Bradley has heard this story like a million times.
But our listeners haven't. So please tell
me
more.
Many of our listeners have heard this story. So bear with me if you have.
Please tell us more.
Well, okay. So I'm at a very high risk of suddenly dying. They often call it sudden death. And so I have an implanted pacemaker defibrillator. Just in case I go into sudden death, my defibrillator should shock me and I will be saved. Huzzah. But I haven't actually needed to be shocked so far. What has happened so far is that I have only been shocked unnecessarily.
And why would a device shock you unnecessarily?
So when I was working out as myself, a young person, I was on the rower and my defibrillator picked that up and thought that I was in a very dangerous rhythm, and so it shocked me. That was just the first time. Later on, I was shocked when I was pregnant because my heart was palpitating, which is super normal for a pregnant person. When you're pregnant, your heart just can have palpitations, and it's not a big deal if you're not pregnant. If you're pregnant and you have palpitations, doctors are always like, oh, pregnant people have palpitations, don't worry about it. But when you have a defibrillator, the defibrillator picks up the palpitations and thinks, oh no, this is a dangerous heart rate. And that's what happened to me. And it shocked me multiple times, even though I didn't need treatment, because it just didn't know what to do with that information and thought I was in a dangerous rhythm. And the only way I could reliably stop it from shocking me was to take drugs to slow my heart rate down, which made it difficult to even walk up a flight of stairs.
So that setting was not even adjustable by the electrophysiologist or anybody else. They couldn't adjust it once it was in your body to do different things.
Yeah, to like adjust the algorithm to allow for palpitations, you know, is simply not. It's not even a conversation you can even have. And one of the reasons is that a decade later from when I started, I'm still extremely young for a defibrillator patient. Patients with defibrillators are only 15% are under the age of 65. And the set of people who are pregnant and have defibrillators is teeny tiny. So there's no information about, they don't spend the time. And so living with my defibrillator all this time stands for the proposition that, you know, our technology really may not be made for us and the uses that we rely on it for, and what are we going to be able to do when it fails? And so my heart device became a metaphor for the software we rely on, and it would just, it totally blew my mind about what this means for the technology we rely on, what we need as a society to be able to move forward when things fail. And it, I've been struggling with the concept of this ever since, because I can't believe that it took me being unnecessarily shocked by my defibrillator to realize how terrible the system we have is. And I really hope that you, listener, don't have to wait to have your technology fail or fire in some unexpected way that has negative consequences for you before we as a society realize that we have to do things differently.
And in this case, you were primarily just asking for the simplest of the rights that we talk about in software, the right to study the software. I think you just asked to be able to review it, right?
Right. I went to the device manufacturers and asked if I could see the source code, and I just got the complete runaround.
Yeah, and you tried to get it from the government too, right? You filed a FOIA request?
I filed a FOIA, but...
Oh, we should explain what a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act, to ask the FDA to give you public information that should be made public. And you asked for that and got...
I did. I got a whole bunch of documentation about various meetings at the FDA, and I found out that the FDA doesn't review the source code on these devices. So, you know, there's a lot of intricacies to this story, but ultimately... what I was left with was this powerless feeling of having a device in my body that I knew I needed, but I had no control over. And not only that, I am not the customer for this device. The patient is not the customer. We don't have any purchase power. We don't have any real, generally, any control at all. Mm. It's the doctors who are the customers, and most doctors have very little technical understanding about the way software works. And especially when I first got this defibrillator, they didn't even understand there was software on these devices. I think in the intervening time, it's gotten a little bit better, but they still have no... They're doctors. They have a lot of really amazing expertise in areas of cardiology or whatever their area of interest is, but they don't have a strong technical understanding. They don't even know the questions to ask. And so when I got a new defibrillator, because I needed your defibrillator is only as good as long as the battery is good. And so when I got a new defibrillator, my electrophysiologist let me be the one on the phone with the device manufacturers, and I could ask them, you know, questions about it. And it turns out the technicians, the people that they had available to answer questions for the doctor's offices, also didn't know very much about these devices, because nobody was asking them any of these questions. And so it's all really fascinating. The device I have now is the only device that was available in the United States where you could disable the wireless communication. So that's the one I got. But as I have my device, I continue to live with it, and I continue to see all of the areas in which there's a mismatch between what we need to be able to control our medical care, what we need to be able to live with our medical devices, and simply all of the technology that's integrated into our lives. There's a mismatch between the corporations that manufacture and deploy it and sell it and profit on it, and the ultimate use cases that are likely to happen. My current defibrillator, which was installed a few years ago, still has 10 to 15 years of battery life on it. If we look forward to that, you know, that time in the future, I don't know what the world is going to be like at that time. And this device could have software upgrades to it, but it's impossible to anticipate what those will be. And so we really need to have the ability to adjust that. And companies go out of business all the time. In fact, the company that I have my defibrillator from has reduced its presence in the United States considerably during the time that I've had my defibrillator. And it is now extremely challenging to get my defibrillator interrogated at a short moment's notice, which means that it's impossible to go into any like normal regular hospital or doctor's office and expect them to have the equipment to be able to talk to the device, get information off of it, and change those settings like the one that I was talking about before when I was pregnant.
And that also might be information they would need if you had a complication related to your condition. They would need that information quickly to be able to treat you, presumably.
Potentially, yeah.
So this experience, this turned you into a software rights and right to software repair activist, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's wild. I started out just thinking, oh, you know, I'm a technical person. I used to code. I went to law school. I have this policy interest. And it was sort of like, oh, you know, yeah, open source is something important. It's cool. It's good for business, you know, whatever. It really wasn't of primary interest to me. And then, like, having this experience with my medical device, it just made me realize, like, first of all, this is a story that people seem to be able to understand as a metaphor for why we should care about all of our software. But for me personally, that feeling of powerlessness over software that is so critical to my very well-being and, like, ability to function in the world is, it just really showcases why we can't just accept what companies do. We can't just accept the software that we are given and expect to have no ability to do anything with it down the road unless we can keep that company in business and caring about our particular use case. And so that's where my position is on software freedom and why I got so excited about it. But I want to also hear about you, Bradley.
Well, I think what we ought to do, so that we don't make our episodes too long, why don't we have this be our first episode? Everybody learns about one of our co-hosts, Karen, has just told you the story of how she got excited about software rights and the software right to repair. And then in the next episode, I'll tell my story and you can ask me questions about it.
Oh, that sounds really good. Yeah, and we're going to talk more about these issues as we examine, like, the fundamentals. We'll bring back our stories and talk more. If you have any questions about my story, if you want to know any more about it, feel free to contact us.
Yep, and there'll be contact information in the show notes, and you'll probably hear it in the lead out as we finish up this episode. We hope you'll continue to subscribe. We welcome all our listeners back over from Free as in Freedom, our old show, and we're really excited to have all you new listeners who are excited to learn more about open source and free software. And if there are any of the terms that you are confused about, you can feel free to write in, but you may find many of those answers come up in future episodes, as we're going to be doing lots of educational work to explain all these different concepts about open source and software freedom to you.
I think it's going to be really fun.
Corresponding Source is an audio cast of the Software Freedom Conservancy, a charitable non-profit organization in the USA, dedicated to the right to software repair. We're supported by your donations. Visit sfconservancy.org to learn how to support us and subscribe to the cast. You can email us at cast@sfconservancy.org.
I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is the Karis.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.